right? Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning and Happy New Year to you all. Welcome to oral argument at the Supreme Court. Before I call the first case, we have some students who are here with Court with Class. And my notes says that Bigfoot Union High School is here. Is that correct? And if so, would you all please stand? Oh, wow. You have a big group. Well, thank you so much for joining us. You may be seated.
It's Bigfoot?
Bigfoot Union High School.
It's a bigger foot than I realized.
Well, that's very good. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. The students are here as part of Court with Class, and after our second argument this morning, which should end at about noon, one of the justices will come and talk with the students about functioning of the Supreme Court. The justices won't talk about the merits of the case, but she will talk about procedures and how things come to the Supreme Court. And today, Justice Annette Ziegler is going to meet with the students at approximately noon. There are some other students who are coming to the 10:45 and another group to the 1:30. So we may really have a full house because all will be invited to the proceedings that will begin at about noon. Now, I have said about noon a couple of times, and the reason I've done that is we allow an hour for oral arguments. So each side gets 30 minutes. That should, since it's now about 8 minutes before 10 o'clock, get us to about noon. The lawyers are unfailingly proper, and when the red light goes on, which is their signal that they shouldn't be arguing their case anymore, they do stop, unless they're in the middle of answering a pending question, do so. However, sometimes my colleagues are not quite so good about adhering to the red light. So I will try to encourage my colleagues, as well as the lawyers, to do that. Because if the argument run on and on, I always give additional time to the side that wasn't being asked questions when the first side went over the time limit. What that does is it ends up eating up the noon hour, and often the students have to leave without having the opportunity to meet with the justice. So in the interest of fairness to both parties, so they both have the same amount of time, and in the interest of having the noon hour really be a time when they can meet with the justice, you may find me urging people to ask their questions during the allotted time, but not to ask questions after the red light goes on. Now, you've all stood up and been introduced to us a bit, and let me introduce the justices on the court to you. And I begin on my far right-hand side, Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to Justice Prosser, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler, with whom you will be meeting at noon, and on the far left-hand side of the bench is Justice Rebecca Bradley. So with those preliminaries out of the way, I will call the first case, State versus Salinas. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do.
Let me just say at the outset so that it's clear, on occasion we do run over, but that's because we are so committed to getting the right answer. Cases wouldn't be here before the Wisconsin Supreme Court unless they were important cases. So we beg your indulgence if that happens, but it's only because we're committed to our job and making sure that it's done right that on occasion it does.
And because we are committed to fairness, if one side runs over, I will give the other side more time. So we'll try to stick within the time limits. Please begin.
For giving them more time, so thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd, representing the state of Wisconsin. The state asks you to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals that had reversed Salinas' judgment of conviction based on misjoinder. The Court of Appeals decision misread both the law and the facts in this case and ended up too narrowly applying joinder law here. The state asks this court to reverse the decision and conclude that, as a matter of law, the three sexual assault charges and the two victim intimidation charges were properly joined for trial.
If I can, let me interrupt you right away. Sure. It's my understanding that the state recognizes that whether there's joinder is a question of law. And that's because 971.12.1, if I've got the right numbers, sets forth three prongs that are to be met, right?
Yes.
And that's a question of law. Did the state or whoever is saying the joinder is okay? Did the state meet those three prongs, right?
Yes.
Okay. There's no question. This is not in. Question of discretion. Is that right?
Yes, our position is that it is de novo review.
De novo review, even if it's a matter of discretion. If in discretion an error of law is made, it's a question of law then. The discretion is a question of law, right?
Not sure I understand.
Well, if you say that an issue is discretionary with the trial court, if the discretion is exercised on an error of law, and it's an invalid exercise of discretion, right?
Sure, yes.
All right, I just am trying to lay groundwork on so that we get rid of any extraneous matters that aren't an issue between the parties. So
okay.
This is a question of law. Now, which of the three prongs are you relying on?
We are relying on what I would call the third prong, the two or more acts or transactions connected together or constituting part of a common scheme or plan.
Right,
are you saying this was all part of one continuous course of conduct?
In a way, yes. I think that third prong is sort of almost two prongs. I'm not sure how, I mean, there's a bunch of conjunctions in there, but I would say it's what he's done is almost a fluid set of acts that are part of a common scheme or plan to abuse and manipulate the folks with whom he lives, and it's all part of his common plan.
So it sounds like the answer to my question is yes.
I think so. If you would you mind repeating it again?
Are you saying that this is a part of one continuous course of conduct?
I mean, course of conduct isn't the term in the statute, so I would refer back to this term of statute, which is connected together.
What?
I would use the term in the statute that they're connected together.
Can I ask you if you're done? Are you done answering that question? I don't want to interrupt your.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. And I'm just putting this out there. I'm not trying to ask you an unfair question. So let me start with that. And opposing counsel, I just want you to kind of think about this too. I'm thinking from a practical perspective as a trial court judge, if you are confronted with a preliminary hearing and you're conducting the preliminary hearing, the judge has to hear the testimony, and then the judge makes a determination of whether there's sufficient evidence introduced for bind over, right?
Uh-huh.
The analysis in that context of a felony isn't that there has to be evidence of every possible crime introduced at a prelim in order to bind over. In fact, the analysis is one of, is it transactionally related? And so I think of this case, at least in part, as being somewhat analogous to the transactionally related analysis. It can't be easier to charge after a prelim Janet. So how, if at all, does that impact the wording of this statute, if you've thought of that at all? It's just something that came to my mind as I was digesting this and thinking through it from a practical perspective. So I throw that out there, not trying to be unfair, but telling you it is something I'm thinking about as I'm noodling through the issues here. Okay?
So what's the question?
Do you understand what I'm talking about?
I think so, but I will say I had not thought of that. I don't know that it's, I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's unfair, but it had not occurred to me to.
Well, you'll have time, and so will counsel, which is why I'm bringing it up early, because you have a second shot to talk at us. But counsel doesn't, so it's giving you both a heads up of something that's going on in my mind, because the analysis would have to be at least somewhat similar, wouldn't it? Okay.
Let me think about that.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you've been taken off track of what you wanted to say for some time, but go right ahead, either on my point or question or whatever else you wanted to say.
Well, our position is just that they were properly joined on October 20th, 2010, because the state presented evidence that they were connected together or they were multiple acts constituting parts of a common scheme or plan satisfying 971.12 sub 1. In thinking about this case, what I think the defendant is really complaining about is more of an evidentiary decisions, which are not before the court. So I think it's important to think about what's not before the court, which is there was no motion to sever the counts. There was there's no appeal of any objection to an other acts motion or a denial of an objection to other acts evidence, and there's no appeal of any denial of any evidentiary ruling that the circuit court made. The only issue is the joinder decision that was made a year and a half before trial in a pretty brief 6-page decision. And as we know, joinder is to be liberally construed. So I think that after that point, if what the real issue was is that Mr. Salinas didn't want the evidence of some parts of the October 26th domestic violence incident to be admitted into evidence as part of the victim intimidation, there may have been ways to exact that from the testimony and still keep in the victim intimidation counts. Perhaps there could have been an objection after the evidence of the strangulation and suffocation that could have kept out the information regarding the threats to his son. But there was no such objection.
So you think that the whole concept of the other act's evidence was waived or forfeited?
I do.
Okay. So it's irrelevant for us to consider that in terms of joinder. And what about in the harmless error? Do we consider it in harmless error? Isn't that another issue in this case? You say the only issue is joinder. That's not the only issue, because if the joinder was wrong, still could say this is a harmless error case. Don't you argue harmless error?
I do, but I do think our joinder argument is really strong, and I don't see how, in thinking about it more and more, and the application of joinder in other contexts, when the risk of perhaps bleeding over and convicting a defendant because they'd done something wrong, like in Francis, where you have a similar MO and you worry that a defendant is going to be convicted because he did something so similar, that prejudicial joinder seems to be a bigger concern. Whereas in this case, I don't see that so much. So I feel like the joinder here, I have a hard time seeing how the circuit court erred in finding
Don't you think we should go through the facts of these two joined cases in order to determine whether they meet the criteria and the statute? Now, well, there are three cases, as I understand it. Domestic violence, which is 09 CF 1267, that wasn't joined.
That was not joined.
And then you have 10 CF 542 sexual assault, which is three counts with VG as the victim. And it was joined with 10 CM 1571, the intimidation charge. Right?
Correct.
And according to the facts, I mean, I think you ought to try and give us a timeline and
sure.
See what this all looks like, because isn't that how you test whether the joinder was correct?
Yes, I think that's helpful, yes. Okay.
Want to do it or shall I?
I
prefer you do it.
Okay. My timeline shows that in April of 2007, Mr. Salinas started to sexually assault his girlfriend's daughter.
When was that charge raised for the first time?
He was charged with...
When did she report it for the first time?
She reported it in May 2010.
Okay.
And he was also charged in May 2010.
Okay, so that's 3 years later.
Right. Right.
Okay, go ahead.
In October 2009, he slapped and raped VG, which then led to the domestic violence incident.
Right.
Which led to his arrest and jail.
Right, and that's not joined here.
Well, part of it is because the underlying crimes that led to the victim intimidation and the part of victim intimidation that requires the state to prove that the victim is a victim of a crime, that element of victim intimidation is part.
So when are the intimidating calls made?
As initially charged, they were charged from October through May, but as submitted to the jury, I think they were in the jury instructions from April to May.
15 through 19, 2010. Isn't that right?
Yeah,
okay. Go ahead.
He was sentenced for the October incident in May.
The October incident being domestic violence?
Correct.
All right, which is not joined, okay.
Right. Go ahead. So then in May 13th, she discloses the sexual assault. May 19th, he's charged with the sexual assault. In October 2010, the victim intimidation charges are filed.
June, July, August, 3 months later, okay.
My understanding, I could be wrong, is that they didn't discover the phone calls until then.
Yeah, in August, the police listened into his telephone conversations and recorded jail calls from Salinas to MS and obtained statements from MS and VJ regarding the intimidating calls.
Right? There were 500-some calls, so.
Not all of them reached the destination, right?
Right.
How many reached the destination?
I don't know.
Okay.
And then on October 18th, the state moved to join the intimidation with the sexual assault.
2010?
Yes.
Okay. So now tell us how they're connected. Or they fit the statutory criteria.
97112. One allows joinder for two or more acts connected together or constituting part of a common scheme or plan. I would say that Salinas's abuse, sexual and physical of VG, as well as his intimidation of VG, the sexual abuse and physical of VG also included threats to her brother and her mother, was all part of his scheme and plan, to abuse and manipulate those in his household.
What's the difference between I have a scheme and I have a plan to abuse and manipulate? People understand what a scheme is, you know, a scheming person. What you're planning, I plan to do something next week. I plan to be abusive and manipulate for the next few years. Is it really a scheme or a plan, as those terms are commonly defined? Or are you just dealing with a personality that's abusive and manipulative? And what's the difference?
I don't know that there is a difference, and I think that that's why this is supposed to be used so liberally, to allow these charges to be joined together, and then there's a discretionary determination to sever them when we find that there's too much prejudice.
When you say there is no difference, aren't you reading out the words scheme, plan, and making them superfluous? Because you're saying, hey, if a defendant is manipulative, if a defendant is abusive, those are his kind of traits, then that equals a scheme or plan. That doesn't make sense to me, because it defies to me what I understand to be the dictionary definition of words like scheme and plan.
Well, I think I'm putting common scheme or plan. I mean, there's a commonality here of victims. There's a commonality of people in his household. There's a commonality of his actions. It's not that he just abuses anyone on the street, or he just is mean to the mailman, or, I mean, it's specific victims within his household and the manipulative nature with how he treats them and the threats that he makes to them.
The problem I have is, if you kind of mush together scheme and plan with an abusive personality and a manipulative personality, you see, I happen to believe that we have a huge number of criminal defendants, many who are ultimately incarcerated, who are abusive and manipulative, and oftentimes subject to mental health issues and substance abuse issues. I mean, these are characteristics of the population, and so if you sweep too broadly and include every one of these defendants who's abusive and manipulative and say that's a scheme or plan, boy, that seems like you're just way too broad on this.
I'm not suggesting, and I didn't mean to suggest, that it's just that he's manipulative. It's that he's manipulative in a specific way to VG, MS, and his sons, in a way that he beats them, he sexually assaults them, he threatens to send them to Mexico, he threatens to take them away. It's pretty specific, and it's part of his common scheme to keep them in line and doing what he wants them to do. I think that's pretty specific.
I wonder, counsel, you've thrown by contrast. You've said, well, it's not as if he's beating up the mailman, or whatever you said about the mailman. I wonder if you could use the facts of this case to tie together, to illustrate for us how you think it was a common scheme or plan, or as it's been interpreted in case law, a continuous course of conduct.
Well, I think, as I outlined in my brief, that this was a pretty fluid situation. I mean, he's abusing her for years. He's telling her for years that if she discloses, he will either send her away or her brother away, or he's making threats. He's physically abusive to her. She's living under this household where she's not allowed to leave the house with her mother. He takes her out of school for a month at a time. She's not allowed to have much of her own control. Her mother's under his control. Then, you know, one day things come to a head, and there's this severe domestic violence incident, which allows the reporting to the police, and then he gets finally out of the house. But then while he's out of the house, there's these intimidating phone calls that cause the mother and the daughter to testify favorably at the sentencing. And then days before he's to be released, the daughter breaks down and discloses the sexual assault. I mean, this is part of what I'm trying to say when I think that the Court of Appeals was too narrow on the facts of the case and separated these things out as if there was some sort of isolated incidents, where I think this is all part of a course of conduct. This is all his manipulation and his control over everything that was going on. And
how does the sexual assault fit in with that?
I think it's part of his control of what goes on in the household. It's how he's controlling VG.
I have a follow-up question to what I think was Justice Gableman's earlier question, going back to the statutory language. We have a lot of ors in that statutory section, and I just want to be clear on what your argument is focusing on. I look at it as there are four components to the statute, and I want to see which of those phrases you are most relying on in your argument. One is, are of the same or similar character. The second is, are based on the same act or transaction. The third is, on two or more acts or transactions connected together. And I think that's the key phrase within that phrase. And the fourth is constituting parts of a common scheme or plan. So which of those, and it may be more than one of them, but which of those are you relying on in making your argument? Do you think that each of them apply in some way, or is there one or more that you are relying on?
We are not relying on the first two, the same or similar character or the same act or transaction. And then the one that you identified as two parts, I wasn't sure if that's two parts or one part. I don't know, there's just so many conjunctions, that the two or more acts or transactions connected together or constituting part of a common scheme or plan, I read that almost as one, two or more acts or transactions constituting part of a common scheme or plan.
I think I might be looking at it a little differently than you. Thank you for eliminating the first two so we can focus on the second two. We have or on two or more acts or transactions connected together or constituting parts of a common scheme or plan. In my interpretation, I think two or more acts or transactions modifies both connected together and constituting parts of a common scheme or plan. So we have to have two acts or transactions. If you disagree with me, that's fine. Please explain. But which of the two, or are you focusing on both?
Both. Either one. Okay. I think it fits under either one. I think that they're connected together. Like I said, I think it's sort of a fluid situation that they're all intertwined in a way. And then I think that they also constitute part of a common scheme or plan, like I said, to manipulate, abuse, control. Part of his MO in this household was, I think it was all part of his whole being, really.
And I have one more follow-up question on the connected together part. So when I'm looking at the timeline of events, it was October 26, 2009, that the defendant was arrested for the domestic violence charges, which were not part of the joinder. Those were the intimidation charges and the sexual assault charges. There was an allegation that on that day, in addition to the domestic violence incident, that there was also a sexual assault of VG. And then when the defendant was in jail, that's when there were the allegations of him making intimidating phone calls with respect to the domestic violence incident. Are you tying the intimidation charges to the domestic violence incident and to the sexual assault charges, because on that one day there was an allegation of sexual assault in addition to domestic violence, and the intimidation charges are that therefore linked to each of those separate set of charges? I know that's a really long question. Are you following me?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it could have been tied that way, the way the evidence came out at trial, and I think the jury instruction could have been submitted that way with regard to the intimidation charge with VG. However, the jury instruction charge, as far as the intimidation went, said that the jury had to find that she was a victim of battery, not the sexual assault. Does that answer
yes,
your
thank
question?
You.
I have a question. This state is very much committed to evidence-based decision-making. I think you're familiar with that. And the Attorney General's office has been one of the leaders on that. And on that, I rely on witness identification. As you know, the AG's office has led in fostering evidence-based ways of doing identification of the perpetrator. Well, since many of these joinder cases, and I wrote one, which was it Francine or Francis?
Francis.
Francis. And talked about a joinder. Their joinder was needed for identification. And I think that is correct. Correct decision, and I stand by that. But since then, there's been some research that indicates that there's an impact by joining several criminal cases. And the empirical study seemed to show that you increase the likelihood of a conviction when you join charges, because the jury says, oh, not only did A, but he did B, C, D, and E, and must be a bad boy or girl, and find him guilty. Now, I'm not a bear on these empirical studies, and I only picked one, but there may be others. And the one that I found was Leopold and others, the impact of joinder and severance on federal criminal cases, an empirical study in 2006, printed in Vanderbilt Law Review. And they said a defendant's chances of convictions increased by more than 10% if he stands trial on more than one count. So my question to you is, have you kept up with this, and does that research hold up? Has there been other empirical studies, and isn't that important in this case?
My red light is on.
Pardon me? You may answer the question.
I am not disputing that science. That makes a lot of sense to me, but I would say that would be a motion for severance as far as undue prejudice goes under 973-12-3, and we did not have that motion here.
Well, you should look at that, because that isn't the way we use empirical evidence, and to the extent that it might have that kind of significant effect, then you could argue you don't get to harm. That it's not harmless error, and that it shouldn't have ever been joined in the first place because it's highly prejudicial. But you're not familiar with it. I'm only familiar with that. That's a law review article, so it's something worth thinking about, seems to me.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Sorry, we can't hear you. And I should say that the court has spent at least $100,000 to repair the system in this court. And from my perspective, at least the loudspeakers we have at each of the table, at each of our working better, but I'm not sure that it's working better without this box that I'm listening to.
Okay, I'll try to enunciate more clearly and loudly. And I represent Mr. Salinas in this case. There's no dispute that this was an ugly and complicated case, but I think the Court of Appeals got it right, and they got it right for a very simple reason. As even the state concedes in its brief, the evidence of the sexual assault crimes was so different from the crimes that led to the domestic abuse charges. And the domestic abuse charges, the evidence there was so prejudicial, it was essentially character evidence. And in fact, the basis for the state's joinder is kind of an overarching scheme, which sounds a lot like propensity toward criminal activity.
Counsel, what is your response to your opposing counsel? When I asked her that question about the sexual assault, she said that she thought it was part of an overall scheme or plan for control or manipulation. What is your response to that?
My response is that if you're talking about an overarching scheme, it's not a specific scheme. It's more of a character issue. It's more of a character for manipulation, a character for violence, propensity evidence that has been kept out of Wisconsin courts for 100-plus years. It's not, as the state says, they're very different acts.
Well, put another way, you seem to be saying that sexual assault has nothing to do with the domestic violence or the victim intimidation.
In this case, the sexual assault charges...
Yes, yes, correct. Counsel, I am talking about this case.
Yes, that's what I meant. I'm sorry. Yes, they did not have anything to do with one another. The intimidation had to do with the domestic violence case. The sexual assault case was separate. There was a bit of temporal overlap there between that October day when there was a slap, and then later in the day, like 5 hours later, there was a domestic violence incident in which not only was Mr. Salinas convicted of severely abusing his girlfriend, but threatening his son, threatening to kill his son with his son right there. And so when that evidence came in, it became impermissible character evidence, and it was not related to the sexual assault in any way.
But there wasn't, as I understand, an evidentiary argument made in the courts below that this joinder wasn't possible because the evidence that would come in would be character evidence, right?
There was an opposition to the joinder motion, and there were some contemporaneous objections to the evidence coming in when the domestic violence evidence came in. The basis for the opposition to the joinder motion is that the two charges were not sufficiently related.
Right. But then you said, after you followed that up, you said that there was some objection when the evidence came in at trial. Was the objection based on the fact that it was impermissible character evidence?
I'm trying to remember the exact objections, and they had to do with MS, the mother, testifying as to what actually happened, and the trial attorney objected to, I believe the phrase was, all the gory details coming in. So it was
doesn't
not...
Doesn't sound like character evidence to me. I mean, how is the trial court going to focus its analysis when what you're complaining about is gory details when you have a gory crime? What you're telling me is that there was character evidence that shouldn't have come in, and that's what it was. It wasn't a common scheme or plan. But I guess I'm asking you, was that objection made earlier? You have to make your objections with enough particularity that the court can understand them and address them properly.
No. There was an objection to joinder, and then the rest of the case kind of flowed from that. I think the trial attorney felt that after the cases were joined, everything was coming in because it wasn't other acts. Say it was all part of the same charge and the underlying evidence supporting that charge or those charges.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Well, if that was waived, then is there any case left here? If the court should say that the introduction of this other act's evidence was not objected to, therefore it was forfeited or waived by the defendant, is there anything left to this case, or should it be improvidently granted?
I don't think it eliminates the case because, I mean, there was an objection to joinder, and the evidence that came in was certainly highly prejudicial. I know that there wasn't specifically a 90403 objection made. However, by objecting to the initial joinder, the trial attorney was trying to keep out the evidence of the intimidation and the underlying domestic violence.
So your position is once there was an objection on the joinder, it was because this evidence was going to come in, and the end, the court had ruled, and fighting it out again might not be worth anything. It's all part of the joinder.
Correct. And then it goes to the, you know, there's misjoinder, and then it goes to harmlessness of the joinder if the joinder was properly granted.
I see this being a bit circuitous. Failure to object to character evidence specifically wasn't raised, so it could be waived, and yet the state doesn't raise that as an issue, so the state arguably waived that as an issue. So we've got a lot of potential waivers going on, and I know the state argues waiver with regard to failure to sever, but not with regard to character evidence. In fact, it's this character evidence, I think, as I read the Court of Appeals opinion in paragraph 27, when it sums up its analysis of misjoinder, it says, it appears the state may believe it was appropriate to join the cases because the victim intimidation and sexual assault allegations generally demonstrated Salinas's character trait of being manipulative. If so, that does not satisfy the joinder requirements of 971-12-1. And that's what I was asking about earlier. Let's take a look. I mean, rather than painting a broad picture, let's take a look at the facts of this case. And the correlation between intimidation and sexual assault. Let's look at the phone calls. What's your answer? Were they related to what? Only the sentencing of domestic abuse? Or were they related to the sexual assault?
No, they were only related. The ones that were recorded were the only ones that they reviewed, and they were all related to sentencing regarding the domestic abuse. I would assume that if they had thought that Mr. Salinas was trying to intimidate victim or witness in the sexual assault case, they would have charged him in the sexual assault case with that since that was pending. But they only charged him with intimidation with respect to the domestic abuse incident.
Were there any recorded jail calls in which Salinas was berating or threatening VG as opposed to MS, the mother?
Not that I'm aware of, not that it's in the record.
Is the testimony of MS, what's the testimony of MS relative to whether or not she relayed Salinas's telephone, and I'll put in intimidation to VG? What's the record show?
The record shows that she said she did not relate the content of those phone calls, or at least all the content of them. Obviously, she communicated with VG about making a favorable statement at sentencing based on the possibility of getting some reward for it. But she said she did not relay any of the threats or any of the kind of abusive language to VG.
I'm back to my prelim and amended information question. And I'm going to ask you, if you can, to help me out on that. You had a misdemeanor case here and a felony case, and we're discussing here the issue of joinder, right?
Right.
In this case, the state filed, the defendant waived his right to a prelim. The state filed the information, and the information was amended on March 18, 2011, to add in the intimidation charges.
And then it was subsequently amended in November of 2011 to amend essentially the dates of those. So that brings me back to sort of the practical way these things are done. Was joinder necessary to this analysis, or is the analysis whether the amended information survives the transactionally related analysis?
Well, I think joinder and the charging document, the transactional relationship of the charges in the charging document itself are different questions if you're talking about a prelim.
Different and they're similar. Do you see what I mean? Are you two now tracking with my initial question that I asked? Because it can't be that there's such an amazingly different test when you're talking about, can you just amend an information and add these things in? Because it's pretty broad what you can do under the transactionally related analysis to add in information in an amended information, which is essentially what the state did in March of 2011 and November of 2011. So is your argument that the joinder fails but the amended information still stands? What are you thinking about that? I mean, that's sort of a hollow victory for you, isn't it?
No, I think the amended information was filed after the joinder motion was denied. So if the joinder motion had been granted, then that amended information would not have been filed.
Well, it would have been essentially the same thing, but my question to you then is, and I mean this in the most respectful way, to me, you have to address whether these are transactionally related in terms of a felony, because if no one ever brought the motion for joinder and the state just amended the information as they did here, the analysis would be, are they transactionally related, right? So, in other words, if you win today, let's just say these aren't properly joined, then the state's lesson is don't go through trying to join files. Just amend the information and go under the transactionally related analysis in a felony case.
And that is when it would be incumbent upon the trial attorney or trial counsel to move to sever if that's improper. So
that shifts things, doesn't it? A motion to sever versus a motion to join. Now you're getting to where my questions fit in, okay. I think. Right? Because you're at the joinder and you just want to stay there because the burden isn't on you, the burden is on the state, and you're saying they can't meet it. But are you saying the law is such that joinder is such a unique creature that the state can't meet that, but we don't want to talk about whether it's transactionally related today? Is that really what this case is about, that needle in the haystack on joinder? Leaving open the fact that the state could just amend and do these charges as an amended information or an information under the transactionally related test?
Well, joinder is not just transactional relations, transactionally related. It's appropriate under, obviously, the statutory criteria.
Okay, let me try to parse it out.
Okay.
I get what you're saying, and I know you want to stick with joinder. It's really interesting. But let's just say you win on joinder. The lesson to the state is don't move to join me. Just charge them as an amended information. Do you win under that analysis, too? Are they so different, or are they essentially the same?
I believe they're very different. I do not believe there is much to say. Okay.
Are you able to talk to me about that or not?
It's not something I had considered before this morning.
Fair enough. And that's why I said at the outset.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I have kind of a follow-up question to Justice Ziegler's last question. I'm going to move away from the prelim issue. I want to know if your position on joinder would change if on October 26, 2009, VG, in addition to reporting the domestic violence incident, had also reported the allegations of sexual assault that occurred that day and preceding that day.
If she had reported that at that same time, then I, well, then that, that I, it's hard to know what would have happened as far as the sentencing with the domestic violence case. It's hard to know what would have happened. It's a hypothetical that I don't really know how to answer.
That's fair. What I'm getting at is whether then you think there would be, under the joinder statute, setting aside what was charged with what, under the joinder statute, would that create a sufficient enough connection to support joinder?
No, I don't think so. I think the cases are still separate and that the evidence could be presented separately in separate charges because the, you know, the intimidation related to the domestic abuse was related to the domestic abuse. And the sexual assault allegations were not. You're saying there's an overlap in time then, and then there's an immediate reporting of that.
I think there's an overlap in time, but also a connection perhaps could be made between the charge of domestic violence and the charge of sexual assault because VG was a victim of both on that day. Is that a sufficient enough connection under the joinder statute?
There would still have to be the you know, it still have to meet the statutory criteria. It would be more of a nexus than there was in this case, which I'm arguing there was none, or very little, not enough to join anyway. That would have changed the other aspects of the case as well. And so the state could have presented the story of the sexual assaults as ending on that last day of when the domestic violence incident occurred, and then it could have presented the intimidation due to domestic violence separately. They weren't. The fact that they overlap in time does not mean that they overlap entirely in modus operandi or anything else that would get them under joinder. In this case, there is a lot of temporal overlap of things, and some of the same people are involved, but substantively, it's more complicated than that, I think.
And that's what I'm getting at. Is it more of a substantive, factual issue, or do we have really a procedural issue here because the victim, VG, chose not to report the sexual assaults the day that the domestic violence incident was reported? Do we need to look at that procedural nuance of the case, or is the substance of the factual allegations more pertinent to our analysis under the joinder statute?
I think joinder is very fact-intensive and very fact-specific, and so that would be my answer, is that it needs to be analyzed according to the facts of the case as opposed to looking purely at procedure.
Okay, thank you.
Also, I believe Justice Prosser has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I agree with that. I yield to you.
971-12-1. In the question of whether joinder was appropriate, do all the fact or do all the people making a decision of law have to agree on the same element of that statute? In other words, I thought I heard opposing counsel say, we can eliminate certain phrases from the statute. Suppose I don't want to eliminate that. Do I have to because she doesn't want those phrases?
I don't believe so, no.
This is not like a jury agreeing on a specific element or something. It's either yes, you can join, or no, you can't join.
Yes.
Okay.
Disagreeing, Dave. Who are the people disagreeing?
Well, in this case, the circuit court gave some reasons for joinder, and the Court of Appeals seemed to pick out a particular phrase in the statute and said that's not good enough. And it seems to me counsel for the state has basically focused on specific language.
I think what I hear, Justice, I think it's almost as if the state is arguing for an unnecessary parsing of the statute. I think that's what I hear.
Very eloquently stated.
Yes. That's because I asked his question.
My recollection of the Court of Appeals decision was that it went through each of the alternative bases for joinder and found that none of them fit. It seemed to go through each of the statutory criteria and explained why that didn't apply. So my recollection is the Court of Appeals decision covered all of those.
But your answer is we don't have to parse the statute. We consider the statute in its entirety.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Could I ask this? On October 26, 2009, this is the date of the domestic violence involving the defendant's girlfriend. But this is also the date of a sexual assault. And this is also the date in which the defendant hit VG. Is that right? Is the sexual assault on that day and the hitting of VG, are those related or not?
The domestic violence incident and the incident with VG were approximately 5 hours apart, and VG initially reported the hitting as part of a disagreement, and even Mr. Salinas testified that he had hit her because he was mad at her. And later, after the sexual assault allegations were made, then she said that the hitting was related to a sexual assault. But still, I think those are, although they occur on the same day, they are distinct in that they aren't just one event. There's the incident with VG and the hitting. Then 5 hours later, there's the argument with MS, and then the strangulation, suffocation, and the threat to the son. And so those are distinct in that way.
Well, let me ask you this. As I understand it, BG was sexually assaulted over a period of several years.
Those were the allegations, yes.
Okay. And the defendant was found guilty of that, wasn't he?
Correct.
Oh, okay. But when the sentencing came for the domestic abuse against BG's mother, which she saw, she testified in favor of the defendant.
She did make a statement in favor of the defendant. Yes.
Why?
Well, she said that she did it so that things would be easier for her mother, so that he would stop calling and annoying them. She said a variety of different things like that. I don't recall her ever saying anything about feeling threatened.
When she said what you just explained, did she say that at the sentencing hearing, or did she say that afterward?
Oh, she said that afterward, yes.
She never said she was afraid of the defendant?
In regard to the phone calls and intimidation, I don't recall her saying that she was she feared for herself from the defendant. I know that she may have been concerned about her mother because, you know, she had seen her mother being abused, and she knew that her mother was being called from jail and that sort of thing. And her mother had asked her, apparently, to make a favorable statement. So that was certainly part of her concern, but it wasn't that there was no indication that she was threatened with violence to make a positive statement or anything like that, anything comparable to the threats that were made in the domestic abuse incident.
I don't have any more questions.
I guess in this case, the major problem, well, first of all, I guess I should address one thing. The state says that the joinder issue is waived because there was never a motion to sever. Well, the cases that have that discuss severance and waiver of severance are generally those in which, as Justice Ziegler suggested, there was an initial filing of an information with joint charges, and then there was a motion to sever. In this case, we have separate charges, and there was a motion to join. And so that doesn't waive the issue. I believe opposition to the joinder motion preserves that. It's the reason that propensity evidence for general character toward criminal activity is prohibited is because it leads the jury to want to convict based on factors it shouldn't be considering. And in this case, the jury heard that Mr. Salinas held a knife next to his son, told his son to tell the mother, come back in the house or I'm going to kill you and kill me. And it's hard when that's in the opening statement, it's hard to think of a way in which that person gets a fair trial, because that's about as horrifying an accusation as you could make. And I think that was the real danger and the reason that joinder cannot be harmless in this case, is that that evidence came in. And that evidence was repeated several times. It was opening, closing, and of course they took evidence on that as well. The state took evidence on that as well. So I think that's the kind of bedrock principle, is that evidence of a character for general violence, criminality, is not admissible. And in this case, it came in because of the joint cases.
I don't think you're going to get an argument from anyone at the bench that character evidence is inadmissible. But why wouldn't the testimony that you just described just as equally go to the context in which the events occurred and in which the child's testimony is being presented?
The context cases tend to talk about context that's inextricably intertwined, such that if you were to leave out that information, the gaps would confuse the jury. And I don't think leaving that out would have confused the jury. Also, the context case...
You don't think it aids the finder of fact to hear about the living situation and the interrelate? In response to one of Justice Prosser's questions, you said, gee, I don't think the girl expressed a concern about her own safety, but she had expressed a concern about her mother's safety because she had seen her mother being abused in the past.
Well,
that's what you said. I'm just quoting you. If I'm wrong, then please correct me.
I should clarify that.
All right.
She said, I believe her exact quote was, I gave the statement so it would be easier on my mother.
Right.
I might have given you the wrong impression that it was based on violence. I'm just saying that's what she said. And
what do you think it was based on?
She said that Mr. Salinas was driving them crazy by calling all the time and bothering.
So you're proposing that by testifying that way, she'd end some phone calls for Mr. Salinas. That's what you're telling us?
That's we don't have much more information than that in the record on that point.
On that point, right.
If you expand context so that it includes anything that happened within a few months' time period, what's left of the limitations on other act evidence?
My red light is on. Can I?
Yes, you
finish?
Can answer,
okay.
Please.
I'd be disappointed if you didn't.
Right. For example, the greater latitude rule has been around for more than 100 years now, and even in greater latitude cases and in context cases, there's still language that says that doesn't relieve a court of looking at the Sullivan other acts analysis. And certainly character evidence is still inadmissible. For example, in Dukes, which was a context case, the court made a point of saying the testimony went to an element of the crime as opposed to the character of Dukes. So there has to be some limit. The greater latitude rule can't have an infinite horizon. And I think this case gives the court an opportunity to spell out what those limits are as far as evidence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just to clarify a couple of facts, the VG did testify that she did speak to Mr. Salinas during one of the phone calls, at least one of the phone calls that he made from the jail, and that he asked her to change her statement. When asked why she changed her statement, she said a couple of things, but one of them was that he just always would, like, manipulate and threaten my mom. I just went along with it because I thought that maybe the phone call would stop and maybe he would change. And I don't know what I thought. I don't know why I did it.
The phone calls, as I understand it, were related to the underlying charge, the sentencing, with regard to the domestic abuse. Is that correct?
I think that that's an unfair characterization.
I don't mean to be unfair.
No, I'm sure you don't.
It was obvious, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think that Salinas made phone calls just because he was being sentenced on domestic abuse. I think he was threatening them. He wanted to get back in the house to continue the abuse of VG.
You know, that gets into Never, never mind. I mean, there's nothing in the record that allows you to get into his mind that way. I mean, his sentencing for domestic abuse was proximate, was close.
Sure, but I think it's a pretty fair inference that someone would threaten a victim that hasn't yet disclosed sexual abuse.
I didn't mean that to be a...
Okay, all right, I'll just... For the sake of argument,
don't take it. Let me say this. With regard to prejudice, you haven't issued an oral declaration on prejudice in this argument. You have it in your briefs. Your opponent has. I've been on this court for 20 years, and for 10 years I was a circuit court judge before then. There are probably about 5 cases as a circuit court judge that linger in my mind. The rest of the thousands are gone. And one of those 5 dealt with the fact that a grandmother testified that the mother said she had a knife and was going to cut out the heart of the daughter. And I took custody away. I don't remember any facts more of that case. I do remember the case kept coming back to me and coming back to me. It was particularly difficult, but I remember nothing else. And for me, that underscores the potency of the testimony regarding the domestic abuse. That is, in the opening, in the closing, and in the testimony in chief in the trial. There was this dad pictured with a knife threatening to kill his son. I just don't know how that can not be prejudicial. Unfairly prejudicial. So
So help me. I mean, it's certainly prejudicial, and it's only unfairly prejudicial, I guess, if it doesn't have to deal with the sexual assault charge. In other words, if it was related to the domestic abuse only to the intimidation and not to the sexual assault. That's where I'm having my problem, because I just...
Well, I think there's a couple answers to that. One is that I don't think that that goes to whether they were properly joined in the first place. No. The circuit court
goes to the... If there is error, is it harmless? It goes to the second
place. Well, I think it goes... No, not so much. I think it goes to the circuit court was faced with the law, which says a liberal construction of joinder is what we do under 971, or whatever the statute is, and 12-1. And these are the facts of the cases. This is the law. Are these connected? At that point, perhaps there should have been a motion to sever, which there never was. In the year and a half before trial, there was never a motion to sever based on unfair prejudice. That never happened. So the circuit court never evaluated that under severance law. The other thing that I think could have happened is in the transcript when MS was testifying to the underlying intimidation charges and the strangulation in the DV that made her the victim, which was an element of the crime that the state needed to prove, I think that her testimony could have stopped at some point. I think there could have been an objection to the testimony regarding the son. And once she got out of the house and VG called the police, I think that would have been an appropriate time to break up the testimony, and there could have been an objection, whether under the severance or just a basic unfair prejudice, this is not necessary to prove the rest of the crime of victim intimidation. And there was no objection at that point either. So I don't think that those objections have anything to do with joinder, which is the sole claim before the court now.
Well, you're on harmless error too. That's not joinder is not the sole claim, isn't that right? Well, you may answer my question.
If you find that joinder was improper, then we would go to harmless error.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you both for a very interesting argument. Both did a good job, and I think gave us a lot of things to think about that maybe we hadn't gotten all together from the briefs that you submitted. So we are concluded with this case. We will take a brief break so that other students may enter the courtroom, and those who are here for the second argument may get themselves set up to proceed as well. Thank you very much.